This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Well, here we are again. Another day in America where after a horrible tragedy, we're here to talk about it. And I don't know why, but this one feels different. We're going to talk about why that is. Of course, we're talking about the assassination of Charlie Kirk, which occurred in Utah at a college campus just yesterday, the 10th of September, 2025. The tinderbox in America feels like it just kind of blew up. What happens next? Why did this take place? And what does this change as we go forward? Here we are on the 24th anniversary of 9/11, discussing all of this. And to help us do that, Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, Stacey Cole, Todd Michaels, all with us this morning. I'm just going to throw it out there at this. Siobhan, why do you think this one seems to hit different for a lot of Americans?
The sad truth is that I think for a large section of the country, we are already living in a civil war of ideas. Both sides are not shooting at each other yet, but on an emotional level, it's you use the word tinderbox, it's an incredibly intense and fraught time in the country. And I think when people have a political leader that they look up to, that person becomes symbolic for everything that they believe in. Mm-hmm. And so an attack on their leader really hits them hard. It's like the general was killed, you know, and I did not follow Charlie Kirk. I tend to personally stay away from people that would go in the extremist category, no matter mm-hmm. what side they're on, sure. because I like to just get the facts and yeah. then come to my own opinions based on that. But a lot of people were very emotionally invested in his message. Mm-hmm. And so an attack on him feels like an attack on them and their values.
No, this is, I mean, it's, I can't tell you I've ever listened to a full episode of Charlie Kirk. I knew who he was. I recently listened to a Bill Maher interview with him, which I thought was interesting considering the two are pretty much diametrically opposed on most views. I'm not, I wasn't a Charlie Kirk, fan of his message, but I respected his ability to give his message out there to who he wanted to. That's why we're in America. That's why you're able to do what you're able to do and why you're able to do what you're able, why you're able to do it. I think people on the opposite side of this are also very much affected because this one doesn't, it's as polarizing as a figure as Charlie Kirk could be. At the end of the day, I think a lot of people, both sides of this are very shaken up. There was another shooting. There's a high school shooting while mm-hmm. this happened.
Yeah.
But his assassination seems to almost symbolically feel very different. I don't know. I'm really kind of at a loss for words on this because it really, it shook me. I don't know. It's just, I saw the video and I don't want to ever see that again. But at the end of the day, he was at a college campus debating people. You know, I mean, this is insane that we're at a place where this is what we have to worry about on a campus, on a public setting, a public forum. I mean, should we have already been worrying about this? Should this have never taken place to begin with? Should they have looked at this in another way? Like maybe the risks here are too great to do something like this. I don't know. There's so many would have, could have, should have in this. But then you have a father of two who was brutally, brutally murdered. And it goes beyond any of his opinions. It was just completely, I feel like there's a destabilization that has taken place. Has it? Are we about to enter a zone in our country now where we're going to start seeing a lot more political type assassinations?
I fear so. I also think it's been progressive. You know, mm-hmm. if we look at the list, a lot of people online have been circulating a list of all the political violence. Mm-hmm. And I mean, from going way back, we'd say in the last decade, there's been an increasing number of people. Just 3 months ago, the Minnesota, you know, Democrat mm-hmm. legislator killed in her home and her husband and her dog. And the guy had a hit list of 45 other Democratic names. Paul Pelosi attacked and mm-hmm. hit his head with a hammer. I mean, this is all stuff. This is not what we're used to in this country. I mean, there have always been the occasional political assassination, but it's been rare. It's not been the norm. And I think we've moved into a time where people are so rigidified and so activated and so angry. And then you throw a little bit of psychopathology in here and somebody that thinks that they're the virtuous savior. And, you know, it's a very fraught time. I personally avoid crowds. You know, there are a lot of parades or events that I would normally like to go to. I just don't feel it's safe. And to go to a big political rally outside, I think you're taking your life in your hands at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the climate that we're in, where that is just kind of the harsh reality of it. We react to things in this country when they happen very harsh, and then we have very short memories.
What do we do about it? I mean, at this point, how many school shootings have we had in the last week?
Yeah.
I don't know the number, but I can think of at least three.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I could be wrong. It could be two, but there was one in Minnesota. There's one in Denver. I thought there was another one in between. But, you know, we're outraged for a day and then we go about our business. And when is it going to be enough? Where's the tipping point? Did we just hit it? Did we hit it yesterday? I don't know.
What I'm wondering about this, because I think everyone needs to take in society a big collective breath here on every side. This could be a time, as we're on the 24th anniversary of 9/11, of everybody, like, take politics aside and come together, go, what the hell are we doing? Mm-hmm. Like nobody wanted this to happen. Now, are there assholes out there on each side going and celebrating this death? Yes. And you should probably, you know, go find a hole and jump in if you're doing that. This is nothing to be celebrated. This is nothing. I don't care what you thought of Charlie Kirk, to be vitriolic about or anything of that nature. This is a human being who is expressing their opinion in a country where we are allowed to do it. And we celebrate it as one of our virtues, and yet we're in an atmosphere where the attitude seems to be, let's shut everyone up who has a different opinion than ours. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We can't be there. That doesn't work in a civilized society. And like you said earlier, this differs because it feels like. And we don't know the motivation behind the killer. And I don't even think it matters, but it does feel like it's an attack on an idea on what he stood for, what he believed in, which many people believe in. And they're not horrible human beings. They're fellow Americans with different opinions. Mm-hmm. And we've always been in a place where we live with fellow Americans with different opinions. And Charlie Kirk had all the dangers of a 1994 Sunday school teacher. What I found very interesting about all this, everybody that I was talking to yesterday, the comments that I read, I heard so many people say, yeah, but he said this. Yeah, but he said that. And you know what?
He has a right to say those things in this country.
But give me a second. The reality is, when I looked up 90% of the things that people are spewing to each other, going, he said this, he said that, he never said.
Hmm.
There's so many, there's so much of this, let's jump on the bandwagon, and because he represents this or his view is over here and that, somebody's going to say, well, he says this. Well, did you hear he said that? And it's telephone, and it goes, and it goes. Did anyone ever hear him say half of these things? And you look it up, it's like he's never actually said this.
That's a really good point.
Now, there's plenty of shit. You know, I'm sure he said every side has their shit that they say. And some can view this as dangerous or that as dangerous. But I found it very interesting that most of the big points that I saw people throwing around there online of, well, he said this never fucking happened. Mm. Never said aloud. But people would assign those things to him and then they believed it. Mm-hmm. And then they sat behind it. And then they repeated it over and over. And then people grew more hate for somebody based on things that aren't even real. And I'm not trying to stick up for the views of Charlie Kirk. I'm trying to be a voice of reason here of people. They don't vet anything and they don't mm-hmm. care about facts. They mm-hmm. want to go with a narrative that makes them feel good and makes them feel mm-hmm. most grounded in whatever they feel safe with, whether it's real or not. Can you speak to that at all on why, yeah. Why this is happening?
100%. It's an area of absolute fascination to me. You know, culture traditionally involved the people around us, right? And culture teaches us what reality is, who our people are, who our enemies are, and who deserves to be killed, right? Mm-hmm. And culture has moved online. And that has changed everything. Because what gets clicks online, what gets attention, what causes people to tune in to the stations that they choose to watch? It's emotion. It's amygdala reaction. And the amygdala is that emotional center of the brain where we get fight, flight, freeze. And outrage keeps people watching. It keeps people tuned in. It keeps people frightened and angry. And since culture has moved online, we've seen this increase in polarization and extremism. And people have started to become so enraged, they become addicted to the rage. And when you're that angry, you can justify all sorts of horrible behavior. And so I think that's been the big shift with extremism. I talk about that quite a bit in my book, The Minds of Mass Killers. I have a whole chapter on extremism and the psychology of that. And this really, I think, because how do we make good decisions? How do we analyze information? How do we assess what's true and what isn't? That's the prefrontal cortex. That's the thinking part of the brain, not the emotional center of the brain. But not everybody takes a pause when they hear something outrageous. And do they stop and think, I need to process this a little bit before I completely swallow it? And so I think this is why we see the most extremely upsetting things shared on social media, because it's incentivized to keep people agitated. I stopped listening to some of the network news in 2016. I would listen, you know, through podcasts because I don't have an actual TV, so I don't have cable, but I would listen to some of the news shows. And it hit me one day. My anxiety would go through the roof. My anger would go through the roof the more I listened. And one of the stations was actually playing with all their intro music. It was battle music. Mm-hmm. It was like war music.
Yeah.
And I just listened to this music and I said, this is putting me in my amygdala. Mm-hmm. You know, I do want to be aware, but I want to go for things that are more fact-based and not keeping me agitated. And then I can process and think it through more logically. But humans aren't very good at using their prefrontal cortex. And it's easily exploited. And I think this is part of the culture wars that we're seeing, the chaos that we're seeing that plays out from school districts to local governments to, you know, the kinds of political violence that we're seeing, and now assassinations. And it's a big thing. And when we look at it in the big picture, it's like, how do we dial this back a bit? I think when we have politicians who emphasize, we are one country. We are one people. We may have differences of opinion, but let's talk that through and let's use collaborative problem solving, right? This is how we teach preschoolers.
Yeah, I was just going to say we do that in families.
Yeah, use your words. Don't hit each other. You know, calm down. Take a time out. All these skills. I've said we need preschool teachers running the country because they might do a better job than a lot of our political leaders.
You know, I feel like people are in a constant state of fight or flight right now. And it's been that way for many years, that one little thing is going to set somebody off. If you say something, if you reference something, people are immediately set off instead of, hey, that's an interesting point. Let me think more about that.
Right.
No, it's just F you, you know, and screw you. I'm blocking you. I'm doing all of this. And I've been guilty of that myself. It's the climate we're in. And it's interesting that you talked about the music that a lot of the news stations play. It gets you feeling on edge. It makes you feel like I need to know what's going on because something bad is happening.
Exactly.
When in fact, there's not. They'll throw you the breaking news alert and it's something that happened 2 days ago. It's not breaking news.
Yeah.
Our breaking news threshold has changed.
I don't think breaking news means, I think 9/11 changed that because everything became breaking news after 9/11. It was like a cat stuck in a tree, you know, breaking news.
But it keeps us on edge and it keeps us perched waiting to hear that next big thing. And our bodies can't sustain that.
Right.
Our cortisol levels are through the roof. Everybody is just so on edge that if you're ready to crack, you're this close to doing it.
100%. You nailed it. That's absolutely exactly what happens. Everybody's on edge. Mm-hmm. And some people never calm down. I spend a lot of my workday now with people who just are agitated about politics. And they want to use their whole hour just to vent. And they're outraged and they're terrified. And so my approach with everybody, take a breath. We've got to get your nervous system calm here and let's move to problem solving and dosing, how much you expose yourself to all this. Because there are legitimate things to be concerned about. Mm-hmm. But when you're so upset, you're not able to do any good in the world. And don't let this stuff ruin your life. But everybody's needing to hear that right now.
Yeah. I feel like we've become a nation of abused pets. You know, like if you've ever had an abused dog or cat and... Yeah. Anytime you walk into the room and even no matter how much love you show it, and it's still going on, like I feel like that's where we're at, where we're in this place where we have to constantly keep looking around because what's the next thing that we're going to hear?
Yeah.
And so many of these things that we hear shock us and they scare us. But at the end of the day, in our own lives, in our own homes, how much of it actually affects us? Like if you turned the television off and you didn't consume all of this and 2 weeks later you turned it back on, I'm curious like how you would feel in those 2 weeks of not consuming anything. And did any of it affect you? Did the outside world, the tree falling in the forest, I'm sure it made a noise. It didn't hit your house. It didn't affect you directly. And it's not to say don't have empathy for people that other decisions are affecting. But at the end of the day, we also can't be the saviors of everything to everybody. We have to help those in our immediate control and in our immediate path. If we all could focus on that a little bit more instead of being the social justice warriors for the planet or for large swaths of things that we have absolutely no control over, we might be a little healthier. You know, I said a lot of this with the political climate and things like that as they were happening. I think I even said it to you, Stacey, when all this, I said, look, if you didn't watch anything for the next 4 years, I bet you'd be a lot happier person. And at the end of those 4 years, would you have rather spent 4 years worrying uncontrollably about things that you have zero control over? Or would you rather have spent those 4 years just enjoying life, doing what you love to do and further pursuing your interests and passions and helping people and all of that? And I think if we can take a collective breath at that, I think we'd be a bit of a happier society if we could hone ourselves in a little bit more for the reality of reality's terms that we all live with around us.
Beautifully said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To that point, my life situation changed dramatically about 2 months ago and I'm living in a different situation. I have two TVs in my apartment. I used to live in a home. Not like a institutionalized home, but a house. And everybody's like, yeah, we know. But I don't have the TV on. I spend a lot of time here at my desk. I'm usually out of my apartment doing some other things. And I haven't watched TV in probably, 4 weeks. Like, I have not sat down and turned on the TV. I haven't watched any news. I do once in a great while look at the Associated Press, you know, top headlines, that kind of thing. I've turned off all of my news alerts. And I go to bed with Schitt's Creek playing in the background. And I set my timer for 30 minutes. And that's what I fall asleep to every night. And my level of anxiety has absolutely dropped. It probably for other reasons as well. But I don't wake up anxious. I don't feel like, oh God, what did I miss? What did I miss? Mm-hmm. You know what? The sun came out. The birds are chirping. I'm good. Yeah. That's what I can control. My cats are here. We're good.
Yeah.
You know, you have to look at what's in your bubble and check your bubble, because we can't do anything about what's going on in the greater world. We can't fix it.
And like I said, I think we need if we want to live in this society, everybody is entitled to have their opinions. And and honest to God, there's far more extreme people than Charlie Kirk. Yes. I mean, at the end of the day, he was one of the few who wanted to have conversations. That was the point of what he was actually doing. Now, you can disagree with his views, but his point, he wasn't there with a big sign that said, fuck you, I'm right. It was prove me wrong. Let's have a conversation. Let's have a dialogue. And he used verbiage of like, okay, prove me wrong. Let's talk. It's the old adage of the person in the park with a sign. It's exactly what he was doing, literally in a park with a sign doing this. Right. And he encouraged and he could talk competently. I mean, if you go back and if you don't know anything about Charlie Kirk, and I didn't know a lot about Charlie Kirk, go watch the Bill Maher interview. I mean, if you don't agree with him on much of anything, which I personally don't, but I don't hate the man, and nor should he have died. This is utterly insane. We could disagree, but I felt like at the end of the day, I could probably go have a beer with the guy and we could have a conversation like we used to do. And we could hear each other and go, oh, okay, well, this is how you believe things. This is how you were brought up. This is okay. I can respect that. He wasn't like, and my belief system, I'm going to go in and I'm going to take this away from you. It's like, we can exist. We can coexist is essentially, I think, was part of his message, as much as people want to say it wasn't. He wasn't a let's kill everyone that disagrees with us type person. It's sad and it's shocking, because this is something where I feel like both sides are digging in even deeper to things that are not real. Where you see one side going, well, every Democrat hates him and this is horrible. They're all celebrating. You're like, no. Yeah, I didn't see. I mean, maybe I'm sure if I dug deeper, I could find some real horrible assholes who were celebrating.
Sure,
not much.
But you know what? For the most part, nobody was.
Yeah.
For the most part, anybody I knew who was a respectable Democrat were heartbroken. We're like, holy shit, this is not good. This is horrible. Mm-hmm. So reality check for everybody on this. Most sane, healthy thinking people, nobody is celebrating this shit. Yeah. They are not. You can find an extremist somewhere, yes. And on the same token, he said this, he said that. Take a look and see if it's actually what he said or if it's just what Matilda you saw tweeted, who heard it from her cousin, who heard it from that and this, and her, you know, third cousin's cat told them in a dream. Mm-hmm. And now it's on a tweet and must be true because I saw it and all my girlfriends or all my friends said that that's what he said. Mm-hmm. There was so much of it that's not even real, that we base our rage on. We have this rage that we have that's based on fear and not reality.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we live in a country where you can hate somebody. You can disagree with people. You can be wildly obsessed with hating somebody because of something they said. But that doesn't mean that person needs to die. They deserve to live just like you do.
And maybe you shouldn't be wildly obsessed with hating somebody.
Correct. Period. But in this country, you are afforded that opportunity to be as wacky as possible, as long as you're not hurting anybody. If you want to decorate your entire space in whatever fashion you want, that is all one side. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to have, you know, a Trump-themed apartment or a Biden Harris themed apartment, you can do that. Mm-hmm. That's what this country is about, is you get to be you. You get to do whatever you want to do as long as you're not harming anybody. Mm-hmm. And somebody crossed the line hardcore yesterday. Mm-hmm. That's not what we're about. He has mm-hmm. the right to say anything he wants to say without being killed.
Mm-hmm.
We crossed that line hard yesterday. It's not okay.
And this is not the first time America has dealt with political violence. Obviously, we've seen a good share of it in recent years. We've been in far worse times before most of us were around or were very, very young. And it's a time that I feel like we're approaching again. I feel like the cycle is turning and we're going back into more extreme and more vitriol on each side. The thing that I found interesting, we're talking to Robin Drake yesterday, and I'm curious to get your take on this, Siobhan, you know, with the Minds of Mass Killers in your book. He had a stat, 9% of assassination type characters as of this recording, we don't know who did this. They're still searching. 9% historically actually had a motive that was aligned or opposed what the individual they were assassinating had. 9%. The other 91% crazy shit. It was, you know, like John Hinckley. Look at all of the 91% of assassins, their motive has nothing to do with what the person they're killing. So there's a 91% chance that the assassination, the person who assassinated Charlie Kirk, gave a damn about or did not give a damn about what he stood for.
It's a really good point. Yeah, it's a really good point. I hadn't seen that stat, but it doesn't surprise me because really people who assassinate other people, they're coming from a place of distorted thinking, right? Mm-hmm. And are they psychotic? Usually not psychotic, although John Hinckley definitely was. Mm-hmm. But they tend to be people who are angry. They've got some mild to severe paranoid ideation going where they have this sense of somebody out there is doing things to them. So I'm so angry about it. I'm going to pick a target. And some of them, it didn't matter. The one that shot at Trump, mm-hmm. he had also looked at shooting Biden. Right. Yeah. So it's this sense of, I want to be important. I want to make a statement. I'm angry. And I want to send a message about, you know, who knows what, because they've all got, to some extent, a different motive, but they're vengeful. And they're unhappy, angry people who are just, in many cases, looking for fame. Mm-hmm. They idolize other people who have committed similar crimes before mm-hmm. them. And so there's really this distorted thinking process and this desire to be important.
Mm-hmm. What I think is interesting in the translation of all of it, and you can insert this into any scenario. I'm just going to use the Trump one, not for any political reason, but the shooter there again. He just wanted to shoot somebody. Is the answer to that? Mm-hmm. But the translation, and this is, I feel like so much of just gets lost in translation, is see, they're out to get us. Mm-hmm. Meaning, in this case, I've seen so many folks, Trump supporters, see, they hate us. They're trying to get us.
Yeah.
Who's they?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, who, like, we're talking about this one guy. Like,
exactly.
And it can go the other way, too. And I've seen it the exact opposite, too. See, the Republicans hate the Democrats. See, the Democrats hate the Republicans. Or this supporter hates that. And it goes to such extreme. They want us dead. They want, like, no, I don't think most rational human beings do. But yeah. when we get into our groups, into our tribes, and we start telling each other they want you dead, and the other side's like, no, I don't. I'd like to go out for dinner tonight and have a conversation.
Right.
I don't know why you think I want you dead. Like
right.
We disagree, but we keep telling ourselves these things, and then we get more and more distant from people that don't have the exact same viewpoint that we do. And it gets to the point where when you do see them, it gets more and more distant and more off. And then, well, you know, they're my family's like this. I don't want to do this. And then eventually you're just not there anymore.
There he goes. Yeah.
having part of the conversation. Yep. And you're over in your corner freaking out because the cacophony of voices that are telling you what to believe, you are just consuming it, going, well, these people, they agree with me. They're telling me this is so dangerous and so scary, and all these people, they feel this way and they hate me this much. And then you realize, if you were to come back to that table, no, they actually just want you to pass the fucking gravy.
Yeah. 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 You hit on something that I think is critically important. Humans are wired neurobiologically. We come into the world with a natural tendency to separate ourselves into categories and tribes. And I call it the us-them process. Mm-hmm. I'm not the originator of that term. We'll credit neuroscientist Robert Sapolsky of Stanford, who I think is the most brilliant person in the world in talking about human behavior. But we're all wired into categorized people. And even with infants, if they are raised in one racial group, you know, their caregivers are of the same race, when an infant sees a face of a person of another race, they have an anxiety reaction. Mm-hmm. So we're all just wired biologically to like the people like us and feel very suspicious or dislike the people that are not like us. And this can be racial, it can be ethnic, it can be economic class. But it ends up with this distorted thinking that we're good to the people like us, but the people that are not like us are the thems, and it's okay to treat them badly. And actually, some of the most fascinating research is that when you get really polarized into this us-them thinking, which the media has helped us do for their own purposes, we actually, as humans, not meaning me personally, I try to avoid this, but we as humans get more of a dopamine rush from seeing the thems punished than we do from seeing our side succeed, which is pretty twisted. And I think that's what we're seeing play out. People are so fired up and so amygdala driven and so non-thinking right now that they would rather see something bad happen to the other side than see everything get better for everybody. Because in truth, the only us, them we should be doing is we're all Americans. We're all us. We may have our slight differences, but it's not, we're running the country like it's a team sport, bloodthirsty team sport. And we want our team to win, and we get great joy when the other team loses. So it's pretty twisted.
Is there a biological drive? I mean, you touched on a little bit, but you know, we'd like to think that we are evolved as a species, but I wonder if this doesn't go back to us just being primates. That we 100%. Are driven to be in these tribes, and this is our way of hunting and gathering.
Yes.
Instead of going, you know, into the cave at night, we go back to our homes. That we are just really not as evolved as we'd like to think.
Not at all.
Oh my God. Oh my God. So true. I have one guru in life, and it's Robert Sapolsky, a neuroscientist of Stanford University. He is a brilliant man. He's written so much. My favorite book of his came out in 2017, Behave, The Biology of Humans at Our Best and Our Worst. And he really in-depth explores the ways that we are pretty darn primitive. And we like to think that we're these cognitive, logical creatures. And in truth, we're very emotionally driven. And then we come along later and make up these cognitive reasons for why we're right. But we're coming from this place of very primitive emotions. And he also is a specialist in primatology, you know, so he studies primates. And we are, as I like to say, we're just monkeys that got a little too smart and learned how to destroy the world and create massive war. And there's a lot about us that we're not all we like to think we are.
Mm-hmm. We seem to be very much in a world of, or we like to jump to absolutes where everything is in reality very much in the middle. And there's a lot of gray, and most things fall into the gray. But why is it that we are in such a world? I mean, have we always been here and we are just communicating far more and we're hearing everybody's absolutes in our ears 1,000 times more than we ever did in the past? Because that seems to be a big thing of this, it's this way or that way, period. Mm-hmm. There's nothing in the middle. And this person, you know, because they looked at you this way one day, or you're making an assumption about them because they were at this event or had this tweet or liked this or whatever, then they must be all of that.
Right.
Because of this, it must be all of that. And that's not usually reality.
No. I always say middle ground is where you find the truth. Mm-hmm. And the farther you get out to this extreme type of thinking, you're getting distortion and no good comes of that. So I'm always encouraging people to pause, to ponder, to use that good thinking brain. And if we're ever going to see a shift with this polarization, we've got to gain some skills in doing that and calm down this rage response. But it really does get addicting. People get a high out of being angry. And we can all think of the news channels that feed that want to keep people angry. And I think the media has a lot to do with it, along with, you know, social media. I follow a lot of social media just to kind of monitor what are the trends and what's influencing people. And I can always pick out the thoughtful ones, you know, on my friends list, people who are going to, and that's not the majority. The people who get very polarized into the us, them, we've got to punish the thems. That's worse than I've ever seen it.
What does history show us on something like this, or research about the time window when copycat attacks are most likely to happen after something like this, where it's a politically motivated thing? And this is, you know, he was a very big figure in this, in that world. What do you think history has shown us of other times where we've seen a very hot tinderboxes like we're seeing now?
It's really common 2 to 3 weeks, whether it's any kind of mass killing, school shooting, anything like that, that there's a risk factor for copycats. But I think in this climate, every one that happens that gets attention for the perpetrator, they start to feel like, look, I can be famous. They study all the other people and that have done it. And this is another online thing that they tend to get into. They almost gamify it. You know, they want to top each other. And I think in the coming years, I think it's going to be a very fraught time. I would expect, I mean, really, when we look at the number of polarized, angry people out there who are heavily armed, more guns than people in this country. Mm-hmm. Anybody can get a gun if they're so motivated. We're not doing a good job with trying to rein that in any way. In fact, it seems to get worse every time. I think we're going to see an increase that could probably go on for several years.
Mm-hmm. There's, you know, obviously they perceive this as a safe space to have this sort of discourse. And I was kind of talking about this a little bit earlier. Was that, and I'm not, you know, not vilifying anybody who said, let's have this out there at this setting. I mean, in a perfect world, you'd think you could, but we have seen violence like this many a time. Somebody in a tall building shooting down at people. I mean, look at the Las Vegas shooting all those years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, I think about that every time I go to an event that has tall buildings around it. I'm going to one tonight. And every time I'm at this venue, I'm always like, there's a lot of tall buildings here. I wonder if anybody's checking those. And I'm guessing the answer is probably no. It's like,
probably no.
It'll be fine. And it's like, well, then something happens. And then like, well, what we should do that again. But that's how we forget, where it's like horrible, horrible things happen. It takes just a little extra time to maybe do this or that, or just don't have things in spaces that are going to be presenting as an opportunity for really horrible people. It sucks that we're, you know, we're in a place where we got to do that. But I feel like maybe we're going to need to do a bit more of that. I mean, there's an how does the erosion of perceived safe spaces, I mean, feed into the collective anxiety and polarization that we're seeing?
It's huge. It's huge. And it definitely affects the places I go. When I do go to a place, a concert or something, where I like to go where they check people for weapons before you go in, which at least here in Portland, most concerts, you got to open your bag and go through metal detectors. Yep. And I'm grateful that they do that. But if I were going to go to an event, particularly an outdoor event where people aren't screened and there's no checkpoints going on, I just skip it at this point, which is terrible that we have to rein in activities and normal social behavior, things we'd like to do, just because there are fears of safety. A lot of people driving vehicles into crowds. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, you know, we always think guns, and usually it's guns, but it can be vehicle, you know, attacks. It
happened in Wisconsin at that Christmas parade. It was shocking.
Yeah.
I mean, and the answer, I mean, it's not really a solution. It seems like a big Band-Aid of like, well, let's, you know, basically fortify everything. And we can to a certain extent, you know, until you can't. And I mean, ultimately, this is a mental health crisis that we have people that can go to such extreme beliefs and feel like this is the best way to handle things.
But we're stoking people every single day. Yeah. And we're just stoking these fears that started and pouring gasoline on these fires. And, mm-hmm. and we're doing nothing to put the fires out. Mm-hmm. And that's the part that freaks me out, is it's escalating every single day.
And the thing is, and people like to blame the media is doing it. Like, you know who the fucking media is these days? It's each other. Mm-hmm. It's looking at your TikTok. It's looking at your Facebook page. It's not going and watching ABC News, World News Tonight. It's every person that's around you that's saying something, probably not super vetting much of what they're saying, and you believing it. Mm-hmm. So our media has become each other, a very uninformed each other.
And that's a dangerous media.
In our bubbles. And you know, the media, they used to vet things a little bit. I mean, there is still vetting that goes on in media, believe it or not. And I know, like, there's certain places that are certainly slanted this way and that, without a doubt. But it's like, let's find the villain here. It's the media. No, it's each other. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, it is each other. It is not the media. It's each other, because each other is the media. Social media, the social, that's us. That's all of us collectively. Mm-hmm. Not us with a podcast, but like everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the idea of everybody taking personal responsibility for being part of a solution rather than feeding the problem and trying to be collaborative, because bottom line, the government should be about solving problems for the populace, making the country work well, making sure that people's needs are met. My gosh, can we do something about the healthcare crisis? You know, can we do something about violent crime, about the mental illness on the streets, you know, among the street people? That's where we should be focusing from a problem solving perspective. That's the point of government. And we just don't see much of that happening.
Naturally, when anything like this occurs, you're going to start hearing it, and we're already starting to hear it. The word conspiracy.
Oh, yes.
And I'm not jumping on the bandwagon of this, but we're already starting to see that. Let's talk a little bit about that in a 10,000-foot overview when it comes to, you know, major events like this that seem to change history in some way, shape, or form. Why do we go down the road of conspiracy? Is it because sometimes that turns out to be right, or lack of information, or we don't know what's right? I mean, there's still many conspiracies of things from, you know, JFK. You know, there's, you know, still it's one person believes this, one person believes that. Where do we go in a society with conspiracy on a topic like this? Because I look at some and it's not hard to go, Well, I mean, that could kind of make some sense over here, mm-hmm. depending on what that specific conspiracy is. But we're very quick to jump to that, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. People love conspiracies because it gives them a reason for things. And I think it's another thing about our brain. We don't like ambiguity. We don't like understanding things. It feels scary. And so when you can come up with a theory, even a weird theory, but this is what's going on. This is what happened. I understand it now. I've got this special knowledge. I can make sense of it. People get a sense of satisfaction out of that. I think that's at least one element.
Satisfaction, and I'm going to also say control too. Because yes. when you feel powerless and you don't know what's going on.
Yes.
Is it an escape from that's the thing with conspiracy theories. Sometimes it's an escapism to a certain extent, if it's not real. But sometimes the conspiracy, the idea of the conspiracy being carried out to the level of to which a conspiracy would need to be carried out is far scarier than the actual act of took mm-hmm. place mm-hmm. in many situations.
Mm-hmm. And I think the other element of that is people enjoy on some perverse level. I mean, why do people still believe that Bigfoot exists and that they're in danger of Bigfoot when they go out on a camping trip? I mean, people sort of like being scared sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, there's a sense of pleasure in that. Look at this terrible thing that's going on and we're all in danger from it. And whether it's aliens coming to, you know, all the mm-hmm. great stories about alien conspiracies and all of that. There are still people very invested in that. And conspiracies, yes, it gives people a sense of control. It gives them a sense of excitement. And then sometimes the sense of a little self-esteem boost of, I know the truth and mm-hmm. everybody else doesn't, but I've got it. And so I'm special.
Do we just need hobbies? Do we need something else to focus on instead of focusing on, you know, all of these weird tribes that we've all gotten to be part of?
Oh,
do we need to go join a biking group? Do we need
Yes.
Do we need to do?
Hell yes. Take jiu-jitsu. Take jiu-jitsu.
Take
belly dance. Get out in your garden.
I've been doing the belly dancing a lot.
I am doing the jiu-jitsu.
I'm going to perform for everyone right now.
Oh, I think we all
do it. Tony, I'll go get some dollar bills.
I'm doing belly dancing, but I want to move to jiu-jitsu with Stacy. I think that would be very good therapy.
Hey,
but
let me tell you, you can meet some hot guys there too.
Well, there you go. Yeah. I think I talk a lot with people about having a balanced life, and a balanced life incorporates physical activity. It incorporates taking care of your health, getting your medical problems resolved, taking care of your teeth, you know, all these self-care things. And that takes a lot of time. The older we get, you know, just staying alive and healthy takes time. And people neglect that. They go downhill. Their thyroid level, we've been talking about thyroid this week, their thyroid levels can get off and they don't feel their best. And then social activities, we need to be with people who make us laugh.
Yeah.
We need to find joy. And if we're not, we need to have love in our lives. If it's the love of our pets, you know, volunteering is so good for people. Not that we all, if we're working full time, we don't have a lot of time to volunteer, but something where you're doing something altruistic out in the world. And when you've got all these different activities that are healthy, that are positive, that are supporting your life, you feel better, you do better, you're thinking clearly. And then if you want to make a difference in the world and the political system in some way, you're in a much better headspace for doing it in a healthy, collaborative, problem-solving way and getting out of that amygdala rage reaction.
I think there's a lot of, I wouldn't say almost like a feeling of hopelessness. A lot of people share in things like this and events when things like this happen. And I would say for me, I mean, I do kind of feel that in some ways, because I think at the end of the day, the folks that maybe we used to look to de-escalate this stuff or be the grown up in the room and and try and collectively, you know, bring us together, it doesn't exist anymore. I mean, the first thing we saw on so many things yesterday was more hate. Was and it's like, why are, where did the grown-ups in the room go? Oh, why are we the people who used to be there? I'm talking about political figures and such that, yeah, you know, no matter what side you're on of this, and I'll tell you what, I saw far more people that would have, you know, theoretically, you know, or agreed with Charlie Kirk's beliefs that were jumping on and saying really horrible shit again, mm-hmm, yesterday, more than you would, you know, the opposite direction, mm-hmm, which, but everybody was screaming, the other side is saying this when this side is saying this. And it's like, can we just stop? Can we just, yeah, stop saying horrible shit to each other? And can we de-escalate? And that's where the hopelessness comes in, because, yeah, it's this, you look to for some sort of light and it's just clash. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's gone, that safety net, that grown up in the room. Nobody's the grown up in the room anymore. Mm-hmm. We're all just sitting here ready to scream at each other. Mm-hmm. And when that's the answer, and the calming voices of reason seem to no longer exist in the places of power where they should, mm-hmm, it's a real scary place. And it does, mm-hmm, feel kind of hopeless when things like this happen.
It's really hard for people. People are all struggling with that. I struggle with that. You know, at what point do I go to acceptance and seeing that in my lifetime, I maybe never will see the country that I envision, that I want. And that's a sad thing. So I think there's a lot of grief going on for people, a lot of depression, a lot of anxiety. And when I go to medical appointments now, and, you know, it's a dentist recently, who wanted to know what I do for a living. I said, oh, I'm a therapist. And as he had his hands in my mouth, he was venting about politics and asking me questions. Why is this happening? What do we do? And I'm like,
no, it's a great time for conversation, isn't it?
I know. I'm like, I really want to answer your questions, but you got your hands in my mouth right now working on that crown. Yeah. And so it's leaking out everywhere, the hopelessness, the frustration, the anger. And I think if when we get to vote again, if we have another election, that's what we all really need to look for in politicians, who can turn the heat down and who can embrace everybody in the country and see that we are one people, that we've got social problems in this nation, and the role of the government is to help problem solve, you know? Mm-hmm. Let's focus on healthcare in a productive way, not in a battle, not in an us versus them. But realistically, folks, can we come together and think like adults and serve the country, serve the people that we work for? And that includes all the people, not just our team.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that's the reality. That I wish we could come to in a situation like this.
Siobhan, is that your cat?
You hear her, okay. Yes.
Okay, go. Yes. I just want to make sure, because I keep looking over going, that doesn't sound like my boy, but gosh, maybe it could be. Okay.
Yeah, she's trying to get in the door.
Obviously, someone who's going to go out and do something like this, their problem solving skills aren't the greatest. No. I would say that problem solving skills, again, our way of thinking in absolutes, our problem solving skills, they're not good. What is the answer, Siobhan? How do we have everybody get better problem solving skills so we don't have all of this going on? Is it, and maybe it's more trying to identify what our problems are.
Yeah.
And identifying what are our real immediate problems directly in front of us that we can control and that we can, you know, be a part of. I mean, it kind of goes back to like the serenity prayer to a certain extent, of, you know, just, you know, having the knowledge to be in control, what we can control. Is it we're trying to control too much in our brains, and we're getting too much things being shot at us every which way, shape, and form? Pardon the pun, I didn't mean to say that, the word shot, but is it there's just too much coming at us in too many directions? that we were overwhelmed. And that's why so many folks don't have good problem solving skills.
Yeah, I think doing exactly what we're trying to do today, which is encouraging people to pause, take a breath, think, look at the media they're consuming, analyze, how is this really affecting my mood? Is this helping anything? Or am I just becoming part of the problem, part of that us-them battle? And I think that I try to work on teaching people about their brain, using their thinking brain. You know, I feel like I'm playing preschool a lot of the time, preschool teacher, with just trying to explain things to people. And when I see people really agitated, you know, writing in some fashion, if it's on Facebook or Instagram or whatever, it's like, you know, let's try to get out of that us, them. We're mm-hmm. all Americans. We're all in this together and we're not enemies. We don't have to look at it that way. And so that's one of my goals. One of the reasons I do social media. Yes, I like to keep people laughing with strange humor and memes because I think laughter helps de-escalate that mm-hmm. anger. So there really is a strategy behind that. But also just trying to educate people that when you are living in a rage state, you're addicted to rage and this is hurting you and it's not helping the country in any way. So just trying to keep put that message out there.
Yeah. There was a press conference this morning. We're going to go to that here in just a second. Siobhan, thank you so much for coming out and being another voice of reason while we're having another crisis in our country. You know, that doesn't need to have happened here on another 9/11 24th anniversary. Thank you again so much. Of course, her book, if you want to read it, The Minds of Mass Killers, very fascinating read. Check it out wherever you get books. Siobhan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's go and take a look. This press conference took place a little bit earlier today with the FBI giving us the latest on the investigation into the assassination of Charlie Kirk. Let's take a look.
Good morning. I'm Bo Mason, Commissioner for the Utah Department of Public Safety. I'd be remiss if we didn't start off today and recognize the significance of the day. Historically, on 9/11, law enforcement has come together as a group to recognize and honor those that sacrificed to preserve the ideals of this country, the freedoms of this country. And instead, we find ourselves today hunting a murderer who chose to violate our rights, the rights of an individual within this country. Just to recap yesterday's events, at around 12:20 p.m., political influencer Charlie Kirk was at Utah Valley University participating in a student-sponsored event with Turning Point USA. Charlie was shot at that event. He was transported to a local hospital where he later passed. Last night, his body was moved to the state office of the medical examiner. We will continue to facilitate movements to get him home today and with his family. Yesterday, during the investigative process, we located a couple of persons of interest. We interviewed those individuals. And after releasing them and after clearing them of being suspects, they face scrutiny. They face threats. We asked the public to be patient with the investigative process. These individuals were not suspects. They were people of interest. We ask that you do not impose into those people and that investigative process. They don't deserve that harassment for being subject to that. I'd like to thank all the investigators that are involved in this. They have worked around the clock all day yesterday and through the night last night. Investigators from the State Bureau of Investigations, from county, from city agencies, the university, our federal partners with the FBI, the ATF, and many others. Those are just a few of the people that we have involved in this. I'd like to thank all of them for their strong work. Through all that work last night, we were able to make a few breakthroughs. We were able to track the movements of the shooter. Starting at 11:52 a.m., the subject arrived on campus, shortly away from campus. We had tracked his movements onto the campus, through the stairwell, up to the roof, across the roof to a shooting location. After the shooting, we were able to track his movements as he moved to the other side of the building, jumped off of the building, and fled off of the campus and into a neighborhood. Our investigators have worked through those neighborhoods, contacting anybody they can with doorbell cameras, witnesses, and have thoroughly worked through those communities, trying to identify any leads. We do have good video footage of this individual. We are not going to release that at this time. We're working through some technologies and some ways to identify this individual. If we are unsuccessful, we will reach out to you as the media and we will push that publicly to help us identify them. But we're confident in our abilities right now, and we would like to move forward in a manner that keeps everyone safe and moves this process appropriately. Last night, I communicated with Erica. The family's devastated. As Commissioner of Public Safety, as a father, as a husband, I can only imagine what that family's going through. The heinous event that happened yesterday is not Utah. This is not what we're known for. Over the past several weeks, we've seen the state come together to help families in mourning, come together as a community to show what Utah is known for a state of character, of service, of camaraderie, of a neighboring feel. We will not stand for what happened yesterday. We are exhausting every lead. We have every officer invested in this, every investigator, every local agency. The outpouring of support from the law enforcement community has been astounding. We are investing everything we have into this, and we will catch this individual. Having walked through the crime scene, through the hallways of this school, through the classrooms, I can't imagine what the people on scene felt as well. A horrific event where some of them barricaded in classrooms, some of them ran in fear. Can't overstate the tragedy and the horrific event that yesterday was, and how we will work to bring to justice the actions of one individual or any other individuals that assisted in that. Our state has gone through a lot, and we will come out successful. With that, I'll turn the time over to Special Agent Bowles.
Good morning. My name is Robert Bowles, and I am the Special Agent in charge of the Salt Lake Field Office. Following yesterday's tragic shooting of Charlie Kirk, FBI agents have been working around the clock in coordination with our law enforcement partners. We are and will continue to work nonstop until we find the person that has committed this heinous crime and find out why they did it. This morning, I can tell you that we have recovered what we believe is the weapon that was used in yesterday's shooting. It is a high-powered bolt-action rifle. That rifle was recovered in a wooded area where the shooter had fled. So the FBI laboratory will be analyzing this weapon. Investigators have also collected footwear impression, a palm print, and forearm imprints for analysis. Now, I understand there are a lot of questions about motive. I assure you that all leads, tips, and tips are being fully investigated. As of this morning, we have received more than 130 tips. We thank the community for that. The FBI has brought every resource to bear, and we will continue to do so throughout the course of this investigation. The FBI's mission is to protect the American people. It's to uphold the Constitution of the United States. Any attack on the First Amendment is an attack on the very foundation of our democracy. That is why we will relentlessly pursue this case and the shooter until we find him. We also continue to grieve with the family and the community. It's our community. If you have any video or images from the shooting, we ask you to please submit them to our digital media tip website at www.fbi.gov/UtahValleyShooting. You can also call the FBI at 1-800-CALL-FBI. We truly rely on the public's help in these types of cases, and no tip is too small or insignificant. Thank you.
Commissioner Tiggs Matthews from Sky News. Can I ask about Shidra? Just bear information about him or her. You said a conflict of this thing in terms of that exactly who they are. Can you talk to us about their movements, their demeanor? Do you think it's a man? And also, can I ask, what were the security arrangements in place? Was that group being monitored? It's a question many people will have.
Absolutely. So what I'll release about the suspect is suspect blended in well with the college institution. We're not releasing any details right now, and we will soon. But right now we're not. But that individual appears to be of college age. We are confident in our abilities to track that individual. If we're unsuccessful in identifying them immediately, we will reach out to the public's help and the media's help in pushing those photos. That was a new development overnight, working through the night studying those cameras. So that's something that's new and that we're working through right now. As far as the security, I cannot speak to that. Neither the Department of Public Safety nor the Federal Bureau of Investigation was involved in the planning or security of this event. And that'll have to be a question later for other agencies.
The gun in a wooded area. Do you believe that the suspect could be hiding in the woods? And is that suspect possibly still in this area?
So that's a good question. And it's a question that goes to the safety of the community, right? No, not in those woods. We've walked through those woods and secured it. As to the community, I can tell you that this was a targeted event. We don't believe the community is at risk. However, we are exhausting every resource to find him. And we will do so.
Special Agent Bowles, now that you're on the BBC, from the images you have, can you see clearly the suspect's face? You say he's college aged. Do you believe he was from this university? And how far do you think he may have gone in this time since?
So I can't comment specifically on his face or any details such as that, as it's continuing to be part of the investigation. And again, we'll release that shortly. However, we're doing everything we can to find him, and we're not sure how far he has gone yet.
But we will find him. Have your image of his face?
We have images of the suspect.
Can you trace the gun to the owner?
You've been able to recover. Do you believe you know this person is the person that you're looking for at this point?
Again, as part of the investigation, we're not releasing any details such as that.
Right?
We are exhausting all of our resources to be able to collect those. But that's, again, part of the investigation.
Have you been able to trace back the owner of the gun?
Excuse me?
You said you found the weapon. Have you been able to trace back the owner of that weapon or purchased it?
We are working on that, but again, part of the investigation that I can't.
Agent Bowles, there's been a lot of turnover of the FBI. Do you think that's impacting the investigation?
Not at all. We've got complete and total support from everyone from director on down, and it's been an incredible supportive environment. Not so far.
Our tweets, number one, yesterday, peaceful day, where we announced that the suspect hasn't been.
All I can say is that we're working the investigation the best we have with the environment we're given.
Those are all the questions for right now. Thank you, everybody.
Earlier today, in regards to the assassination of Charlie Kirk, the FBI has now released an image of the suspect that they believe is involved in the shooting. He does, in fact, appear to be of college age, which they were alluding to in that press conference right there. Other than that, there's a lot of information that is coming out at this moment in time, and it's out there. We're gonna move on to another topic here, but it's a lot that we're pulling in. We're gonna be joined in just a lot. Yeah, we're gonna be joined by Eric Faddis here in just a few moments, a defense attorney, former prosecutor. We're gonna talk about the Mickey Steins case, and we're gonna talk about the latest developments in that, because there's some big things that have come out. The unsealing of grand jury transcripts. Now, this may have actually been an accident. The transcripts give us a look behind the curtain of what was going on in those court chambers. If you're new to this case, Mickey Steins, the sheriff who shot the judge in his quarters at very close contact. What happened? Was there some sort of a mental health break? Well, in the grand jury transcripts, we learn a lot more new things about this case and the mental health struggles that apparently were going on. Very, very real for Sheriff Mickey Steins before pulling that trigger. We'll address that in just a little bit. We'll begin by taking a look. This is the reaction of Sheriff Steins right after he went into those chambers and shot the judge. This is him in the hallway being contained by other officers as everyone tries to figure out what the heck is going on. Let's take a look at some of this and we'll comment.
I even transport me in a vehicle before. Probably not to put you in Ledger County Jail.
I mean, why?
Just probably because I don't know though. I don't know if that's happening.
I don't mind to be down there.
You don't mind to be down there?
They'll put me in.
Well, I mean, we'll talk about that. You know, I have to talk to see what the logistics is down there.
Why I gotta get put in a vehicle and go outside?
Well, yeah, I understand why you're worried, but. At the same time, you know how it is with something like this. We're going to be worried about you in the jail down here with local people. Yeah. You know?
Right now, I'm alive and well, no weapons on me. So I leave this building, I won't draw another breath.
We're going to go over in one of these rooms and we're going to talk real fast.
Well, yeah, not in one of these right here.
I don't know. I think they cleared one out. So
I wonder if I feel safe doing that.
Why? I ain't gonna let nothing happen. Okay? I ain't gonna let nothing happen to you. So don't worry about that. I'll stick with you until you go to your cell. Okay? You'll be all right. I promise you. You know, we just talked about we've known each other forever. I ain't gonna let nobody hurt you. Would you talk right here? If we pulled up some chairs, we'll just talk low. We're just trying not to let everybody hear stuff and see everything.
I don't care if everybody hears. I just don't feel safe.
Okay. Well, here you should feel safe. There's cameras here. There's people everywhere. People in there. So if we pull up some chairs right here, would you talk to us right here?
And
no problem. Transport. Well, that's transport is another issue. We'll make sure you're safe on that too. We'll wait until we get you on talking.
I ain't trying to be difficult, guys, but I don't feel safe.
So we got to know what led to this, Mickey. What transpired leading up to this? Because I know it just didn't happen for no reason. Something's happened. Everything has a reason why it happened and why somebody acts the way they do. We'll be fair to you.
Just don't beat on me.
I ain't gonna beat on you. Nobody else is gonna beat on you. You know that.
Don't shoot me. Somebody.
Kill me, nobody's gonna shoot you. Nobody's gonna kill you.
Don't do that. Don't shoot me. Kill cast us.
So, what? Tell me about what was going on earlier today. What was you doing earlier today? Tell me about your day.
It was fine.
Good day. Normal stuff, office stuff. Why was you over here at the courthouse? Just was you had to come over here, drop off some papers, so you come over here to talk to somebody?
Court. Come over here all the time.
For court?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just come over. We had lunch together at street side.
Who did?
Several people.
Who all had lunch? Let's talk about it. What happened today?
Which jail are we going to?
I think, not positive, Mickey, but I think they're transporting you to the Leslie County Jail.
For your safety. For your safety. And, Mickey, you've been around. Most
never make it to the Leslie County Jail.
Why? Hey, who do you want to? Who do you want
put
to
be in Leslie County Jail? You killed where I could kill me in the jail. So
who do you want to transport you?
I don't
of all the police officers here, who do you want to go with you? It'll be a, you has to be at least one KSP officer. Even if you ask one of your deputies.
All right, there's some of the video footage of Sheriff Mickey Stein shortly after he was arrested, essentially in the courthouse after shooting the judge. Very paranoid, as you can see from all of that. I guess the big question is, why is he so paranoid? Is there something mentally going on, mental health-wise? That's one of the big questions that is being asked now. And what we've learned through some of the grand jury transcripts, the transcripts give us a look behind the curtain, how prosecutors have framed this case, what questions jurors asked, and what evidence they did not get. Jurors specifically asked for more medical records. But according to defense filings, they were only read a small excerpt from the doctor's visit the day before the shooting. The diagnosis of acute stress reaction never made it in. Now, that admission has now become the centerpiece of the defense's motion to dismiss the indictment. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, joining us. Former prosecutor, thank you, as always, for coming on. How unusual is it, Eric, for grand jury transcripts, number one, to become public?
Tony, this is super rare. We look at the Epstein case, right? And mm-hmm. the Department of Justice, the highest law enforcement entity in the land, requested that those grand jury transcripts be unsealed and released. The court said, no way. So it's very rare. Here, it's my understanding that the defense wanted these transcripts in part to show what was not presented to this grand jury. And absent the unsealing of that, neither we nor the defense would even know about.
And it seems a little dangerous here because the jurors in the grand jury, it's a very different type of structure. In case folks don't quite understand, it's not like, you know, a regular trial where you have a jury seated like that. A grand jury is a very different kind of inquisition, if you will. But they were asking for more information about the medical records, and they did exist. This adds another layer of weirdness to this whole story of what the hell's going on here. They weren't given the full scope of the medical information that existed for Mickey Steins. Is that a big deal here?
You know, I think it illustrates a fundamental problem with the grand jury process in that it is completely controlled by one side, only by the prosecution. The defense doesn't even get to be there. So we have the jury requesting additional information from the prosecutor saying, hey, in order for us to make our determination as to whether a charge should be filed, we want to see this other information. We want to see what medically could have been going on with the defendant. They were denied that, which I think just really shows a serious problem in the grand jury process and in how prosecutions sometimes go about these things.
Is there ever a justification for withholding something like the mental health diagnosis? I know they were denied that. I mean, legally, can they be denied that? Or is it just kind of one of those things where the system should work this way, but it doesn't always work that way? And when it doesn't work that way, there's really no accountability for it.
You know, that is yet another problem with the grand jury process is how secret it is and how there is an absence of checks on what the prosecution wants to do. Mm-hmm. You know, here in a grand jury process, usually there's not even a judge. So the judge can't say, hey, prosecutor, we actually want you to give these medical records to the jury so they can make a more informed decision. That's not even present. It's really the prosecution just kind of doing what they want in there. And there isn't really a legal mechanism by which the prosecution to be compelled to provide these medical records so that they get sort of carte blanche in this secretive courtroom. And that's what's really being shown through the unsealing of these grand jury documents.
So, Eric, I don't want to backtrack us a little bit here, but I want to know, what is the process for a possible leak like this? Who has this information and how could it have gotten out? And why don't we know how it got out? I mean, in today's digital world, there's a footprint for everything. We should know how this got leaked.
Well, sure. I mean, typically it is released via a motion from one side or the other, often from the defense. Usually in most jurisdictions, they allow the defense to raise a motion to unseal those documents. I'm not sure exactly how they became public here, but they're supposed to remain secret, Stacey. And in fact, that's to protect the grand jurors in part from any sort of condemnation or public mm-hmm. backlash based on a decision they might make.
Wow.
The heart of this case is still the surveillance footage. It's September 19th, 2024, inside Mullen's chambers. Steins, the sheriff, he clears the room of four people. He checks the doors and sits across from the judge. And then he borrows Mullen's phone to and call his daughter. Then without sound, but in plain sight, he fires two shots. Another round at the desk, six more as he exits. Deputies say he later looked blank, almost vacant. He came back inside, admitted it was me, and then laid the weapon down. I mean, the video leaves no doubt about what happened here. So when they're arguing about the information that the grand jury did or did not get, in this case, did not get about his mental health diagnosis from the day prior, it doesn't make a big difference here. I mean, you can say the process was flawed in a way, shape, or form, but he's on video shooting him. What is that change? What are they arguing here to say that, well, this isn't valid? Try and explain that to me a little bit more.
Certainly. So the grand jury, their primary role is to determine if there is probable cause to file a charge against someone. Probable cause is a very low standard. In the grand jury setting, typically they don't consider defenses. They're not considering whether the defendant had some insanity defense that might be valid. That being said, the grand jury sort of acts or is supposed to act as a check on the prosecution. If they want more information about the totality of what happened, because that could play into their determination, then they're supposed to get that. I think defense is saying, hey, had the grand jury been given this information about mental health, perhaps they would have made a different call on this. Now, legalistically, you know, the video is pretty clear in terms of probable cause for this shooting, but the grand jury wanted to hear more. The defense is saying they should have heard more, and that could have changed their decision.
What would it have changed?
If we're talking legalistically here, I'm not sure it would have changed a whole lot, because the grand jury, it's not a full trial, right? It's not their job to consider, hey, what are all the possible defenses? Let me hear from the other side too. Let me make a final conclusion as to what I think happened. That's not what they're in there to do. And so, you know, even if they would have had the mental health records, from a purely legalistic perspective, there was still likely probable cause to bring the charge. The time for defenses like an insanity defense is on the back end, sort of as we get close to the trial phase.
Right after the shooting, rumors started spreading like wildfire in the community. There were claims that Judge Mullins had some kind of a relationship with Stein's wife or teenage daughter. The grand jury record does seem to clear that up decisively. Both women denied any sort of contact. Phone records back them up. The only call connecting the judge's phone to the daughter's number was the one Stein's actually made himself minutes before the shooting using Mullins' device. That rumor, though, I mean, that could have colored public opinion quite a bit. And I mean, shut down, I guess, under oath. The question, I guess, still remains is why was that number in his phone? But if we can point and look at evidence and go, well, it was there, but it's never been used. It's just there. Who knows? How damaging are community rumors like this when the evidence, you know, it proves it to be false before any sort of trial even took place, but they're out there.
You know, Tony, if this would have been the 1920s or the 1950s, we wouldn't be dealing with this issue, because there wouldn't be sort of widespread information that was publicly available. You wouldn't have, you know, people in different states and countries talking about these alleged rumors and that kind of thing. But since the emergence of social media and publicly accessible information, it certainly can play a role. It can play a role perhaps in the future jury pool. This case is going to trial. And that future jury pool, if those folks have heard these rumors, that could color the way that they see the case and could have implications for a fair trial for both sides.
They're going to have to move this trial out of this community, I would think. Don't you think?
you know, Stacey, there has been, my understanding is that there may have even already been a motion to change mm-hmm. venue because, yeah, it is such a close, tight-knit community. Everybody and knows everybody, and they're all talking and that kind of thing. And so it wouldn't surprise me if they try to move this case out of that very limited jurisdiction to somewhere else where folks are less personally affected. They have less personal connections to the case and perhaps even some of the parties and witnesses in the case. So it would be a sensible motion to file to change that venue.
There's so much in this case that we just don't know about. And there's so many rumors in this case and so many just horrific accusations in this case where it makes it what it is. And everybody speculates, well, was he pushed to this because of some of those rumors or because of that information? Or are they facts or are they not facts? And then we don't know. And what happened after the shooting might be just as important as what happened before. I mean, hours after his arrest, Stein's was evaluated at the jail. The intake report, and this is some new information, describes him as actively psychotic, different than, I guess, what we saw in that video that we were just watching. Initially disoriented, combative, paranoid, even pepper sprayed by the staff. Wow. Because and unable to understand his charges off the bat. He was started on, I'm bad at medication names, Risperdione, I believe, and antipsychotic medication is what they gave him. It stands in sharp contrast to what the detective told the grand jury, that Stein's had been in the right mind when he killed the judge. I mean, it's a gap. It's now in the defense's strongest weapon, it seems here. How do you, as a defense counsel, how do you leverage something like that in a jail intake report that so clearly contradicts the state's narrative?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it looks like that might be the most viable defense here is kind of an insanity defense or some kind of mental health mitigator. And the fact that the prosecution really told the jury kind of matter-of-factly, hey, he was fine. He was of sound mind when this happened. Don't worry about that. Mm-hmm. Just sort of goes to show how one-sided that grand jury process can be. So with defense, they're going to get mental health evaluations to try to get an expert to say the shooter did not know what he was doing and could not ascertain between right and wrong. And so certainly some fodder for defense as we move forward. And if I'm defense, I'm trying to bring up the fact that the prosecution left that out of the grand jury proceedings. I'm not sure if a judge will allow that at trial, but I'd want to show that hypocrisy on behalf of the government.
I mean, as a prosecutor, do you try to argue that the psychosis set in after the fact, not before?
I think that's a clever avenue to explore, because certainly some horribly traumatic event like shooting somebody you know at your work inside a courthouse who's a judge mm-hmm. could have a severe impact on one's psyche. And so if those psychotic issues came to light only after the alleged crime was committed, it would not constitute an insanity defense and may not even be terribly relevant. So if I'm the prosecutor, that's kind of the road I'm going down.
Yeah, I mean,
medication, by the way, Tony, that medication is typically used for schizophrenia. They also use mm-hmm. it for bipolar disorder. So not mm-hmm. sure exactly
what. Yeah, they gave him something. I mean, in that, you know, heat of the moment of what's going on here, let's get this guy calm. And so that seems to be, you know,
it must. And to me, My familiarity with this is that you wouldn't necessarily use it acutely, but maybe that's something you would use if somebody is having a meltdown of some sort, for lack of a better term.
It's you know, you could talk to one doctor, one's going to go, yeah, give him that. The other's going to be like, why would you give him that?
Exactly. You know, exactly. So yeah, it may be, it's a long acting injection or tablet. So who knows how they would go about using it, but clearly they felt they needed to.
Yeah. Yeah. The defense is going to be going with the insanity defense. They're going to argue that Stein's wasn't capable of understanding what he was doing. Prosecutors, of course, have pushed back, saying that he knew exactly what he was doing, and they're demanding a second mental health evaluation. I don't know how that would play in today after all this. I mean, the evaluation, I think, at the moment of the crime would be the most important. The defense is resisting that, calling it a stalling tactic. It kind of sets up a very high-stake battle here, not whether Steins pulled the trigger, but whether he was legally responsible for this for the action of what he did. He clearly did pull the trigger. But how tough is that to mount a successful insanity defense in a case where you literally have him pulling the trigger?
It is exceedingly difficult. You know, in movies, we see insanity defenses and stuff, and they prevail. But in real life, it is very hard to win on mm-hmm. some kind of insanity defense, especially when you have this video. The video is going to be problematic for the defense, obviously, in part because it shows the Sheriff Steins sort of acting in a normal fashion. He's not hysterical. He's not mm-hmm. falling over. He's not, accosting somebody. He's sort of going in there in what appears to be a rather composed fashion and then taking a gun, pointing it at somebody and shooting them. And so defense is going to have a hard time saying, hey, this guy didn't know what he was doing when the video kind of details his actions and one can infer his mental state from that video, perhaps.
Yeah. Overlaying the entire case, there's these crazy, disturbing allegations. And I don't want to say they're crazy because it seems a lot of people believe them to be true, but they are allegations of systematic abuse inside the courthouse. A deputy was convicted of raping a woman inside the chambers. Convicted. It's not that's not a rumor. That was an actual conviction. Federal lawsuits claim multiple officials coerced women into sex in exchange for leniency. Some witnesses have even said Judge Mullen was part of that culture. A lot of people claiming that the chambers were like a brothel, basically. Ugh. He's not around to defend himself anymore, obviously. But, I mean, these are pretty horrible allegations. Defense filings suggest otherwise, though. Steins, as sheriff, may have been facing deposition questions about all of it. In fact, he was questioned right before this. Whether fact or rumor, it's a backdrop that adds a lot of weight to this story. I mean, how do these systematic corruption allegations affect a case like this? I mean, can the defense weave them into the narrative of the mental collapse? I mean, with a lot of them being rumor, you do have some verified fact here, but I mean, it's quite a story.
Oh, heck yeah. I mean, it really adds a possible alleged sinister aspect mm-hmm. to this entire saga here. You know, if I'm defense, I'm arguing that, hey, this sheriff was by the book. He was a law and order guy. He's an upstanding dude. And he saw this just egregious corruption within the place where he works, the jurisdiction he works, and that drove him to just lose it. He couldn't control himself after that. If I'm the prosecution, what I'm saying is, hey, this sheriff, you know, bought into some rumors that are likely not true, at least in terms of how expansive that they've been portrayed, and that was his motive. Actually, he knew what he was doing. He was getting back at this system that he thought was corrupt, and that would show that someone, you know, kind of has knowledge of their conduct and has a conscious objective in terms of what they're doing, which cuts against an insanity defense. So I think you could play both ways.
As a prosecutor, do you try to wall that off or do you risk losing credibility if you act like it doesn't exist and it's just this story off on the side that the defense is telling?
I think as a prosecutor, you absolutely try to get it excluded. You say, hey, this has largely not been substantiated. This is a red herring. This is going to distract the jury. It's going to mislead them. The jury's going to focus on something other than whether this defendant shot this judge in the face, you know? And so if I'm the prosecution, that's the argument I'm making. But certainly that could go awry because if the judge disagrees and the jury sees the prosecution trying to push that to the side and the defense is bringing it to the forefront, that might indicate to the jury that the prosecution is withholding information. They're hiding something. They're hiding something nefarious. And juries don't like that.
How deep do you think this whole thing is within the system? Is this something that could go on with just a couple of people, or do you think that the entire department needs to be dealt with here? That people have rumblings, they knew something was up.
Yeah, you know, we sort of like to have this perspective in society that, hey, the court system and police, you know, by and large, they're doing their best and they're above board. And all of these, you know, sinister accusations are just sort of rumors and salacious statements. But unfortunately, this corruption does exist. I'm not saying it necessarily has been proven in this jurisdiction, but you look at other jurisdictions where there was a judge, I forget exactly his name, but he was convicted of essentially colluding with juvenile prisons and sending kids to prison when they shouldn't have been sent there for money. That. So these things happen. And as dark and horrible as they may seem, they can be a reality. So if I'm defense, I'm interviewing every single person who might have some knowledge of these salacious accusations.
But how difficult is that going to be? Or is it, I mean, is it impossible at a certain point? Because you're talking about going into the literal institution that decides what is going to come and go in terms of accountability. They police themselves to a certain extent of what you're right. going to find out. So how do you get in there? How do you get this information? Because if the allegations are true, this runs deep and the whole damn thing is corrupt. And there's someone here, there's someone there, there's someone over there. We're in that chain of information, doesn't want that information to get to you.
Tony, there are so many hurdles in finding the truth of what happened here. And one of those hurdles is, you know, you can interview the deputies. They're not going to talk to you. They're not going to give a statement to you if you're in defense counsel. You can try to interview the alleged victims if you can identify them. Mm-hmm. That's going to be hard. Just identifying, even if you do identify them. My understanding is that some of the folks might have a fear of retaliation. They might say, hey, gosh, in this small community, I don't want to talk about this, sex for leniency corruption scheme that was going on in my courthouse because, you know, one of the deputies is my neighbor over there. And so it's going to be very difficult getting to the bottom of it.
Well, and you'd also probably have people who are maybe embarrassed about it if they participated in it and said, okay, I'll do that for leniency. Obviously, they are a victim as well, but at the same point, may not be something that they want to, they're exactly proud of that this happened and wouldn't want to have that information in the public.
Oh, 100%. I mean, especially when we're talking about a small community, because those folks come forward, you know, what incentive do they have to come forward? What do they have to gain? What is their payoff if they were to publicly out themselves as having agreed to sex with some sort of public official or law enforcement agent in exchange for getting a better deal on their case? That doesn't look good for them, and they don't have a lot to gain. And so there's a disincentive for them to come forward, making it even more difficult to learn precisely what happened in this courthouse and in this jurisdiction.
Well, you have to run into, you know, Aunt Betty at the deli counter, and she's giving you the side eye like, oh, I know what you did. I mean, these small towns, that's something I learned when I got into radio. I started in small towns. Everybody knows everything. And I came from Minneapolis where nobody knew anything about anybody. So, you know, you walk into a building and, oh my goodness, everybody knows your business. Yeah, it's really intimidating.
You don't like getting the side eye when she's dishing up your broccoli salad there. Like, I'll take a little bit more of the raisins in that. That'd be love. Like, I know what you did.
It's the whole thing.
What comes next here? I mean, as it stands right now, Mickey Steins, he's sitting in custody without bond. Prosecutors say that they got a lot of evidence, the video, forensic witness testimony still being processed. They want more mental health evaluations. Defense wants the indictment dismissed outright. A change of venue may be on the horizon. I mean, what began as this unthinkable crime, the sheriff killing the judge, I mean, it's spiraling into a referendum here on mental illness, corruption, and the credibility of the system itself. However this plays out, it's not just going to decide the Steins' fate. It's going to decide how much this community can trust itself and its own courts and the people that they have in there. What's the biggest obstacle right now for the prosecution?
For the prosecution, one of the biggest obstacles is certainly the mental health piece, the possible insanity defense, that's likely the road that defense is going to go down. And yeah, you know, when you're looking at this, I think everyone was so shocked by the factual allegations. This sheriff who works is, you know, with this judge, they're buddy-buddy. They work in the same courthouse. They're involved in the same cases. And so why in the world would he go in and just shoot this judge dead in his chambers? You know, that gives rise to the speculation, hey, was something going on inside this guy's mind? And that's a pretty intuitive inference for some jurors to draw. And so the prosecution's going to have to undercut that by sort of showing, if they can, that this judge was methodical. They're going to want, or excuse me, that the sheriff was methodical. They're going to want to look into what happened, what the sheriff was doing up until this happened, you know, in the days preceding it. Was he, you know, running around the highway naked, or was he doing his job and appeared of sound mind? These are questions the jury's going to want to know. The prosecution's got to look into that.
Would it help if you were running around naked in the street? I mean, does that help your defense in any way?
Oh, it would certainly help the defense. Yeah, it would be consistent with someone who is insane, who can't really appreciate what they're doing, doesn't have knowledge of what's happening, is not able to ascertain between right and wrong. So if there is sort of that build up in a way that suggests mental health issues, that certainly inures to the benefit of the defense.
Stacey, you draw the line between a mental health issue and a free spirit.
Well, Stacey, I was just going to ask, you got plans for later today, or what's going on?
No, I'm looking at my watch. Like, come on, you guys, it's a nice day. I got things to do.
It's time to go feel that fresh fall breeze.
Let's go, baby.
Yeah. If you're advising the defense, what's the best path forward right now? The dismissal, insanity plea? I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think the insanity defense is important because, you know, look, it's not a whodunit. You can't say it wasn't your dude.
No.
It's not a what happened. We have a video of what happened. It's really why it happened. And when we're looking at why it happened, we're in the neighborhood of mental health defenses and certainly an insanity defense. They've got to look into that, and they're going to want to interview everybody who was around Steins, especially in the weeks and days leading up to this event, because those folks might have critical information as to Steins' mental stability or lack thereof building up to this horrible shooting.
Yeah, lots of questions in this and still not a lot of answers. I think even more questions after the grand jury information came out, because it just points to more weirdness in this whole thing of, is there cover up? It looks like there likely could be cover up. There looks like there's reason for there to be cover up. But then you have all this over here. What happened to this man that this seemed to be the best path forward? It's never justified, but how the hell did he get there? Was there a mental break? And that's the big question I think everyone's going to be wanting to get to at the end of the day. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, as always, thank you so much for coming on and giving us your insight into this and all the cases that we cover here on the program. If you want to comment on any of the cases that we cover here on the program, be sure to press subscribe wherever it is you're downloading, number one. And then YouTube, that's a great place to comment on our program and give us your thoughts, your opinions. We would love to hear them, but please do press that subscribe button. For Todd, for Stacey, for all of us here at the Hidden Killers podcast, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.